As the director of the Fraternal Chair of Contemporary Thought, it is my honor and my privilege to welcome you all to this conference. Some of you know, because you were here, and now I think especially of David Pearce and Brian McGuinness, some of you know that 13 years ago, in 1989, we organized the first conference on Wittgenstein on occasion of the first centenary of his birth. I wish here to remember some colleagues and friends who were with us at the time, especially Norman Malcolm, Elizabeth Enscombe, and Fratemora himself. Last year, some friends asked me why we were not organizing a new conference, since it was the 50th anniversary of Wittgenstein's death. Well, last year everyone did. And I think that we had a very good reason to postpone plans till this year. The good reason is this. I thought that instead of celebrating Wittgenstein's death, we had to celebrate that 75 years ago, Wittgenstein decided to go back to philosophy. Indeed, as you all know, it was in 1927 when he became again interested in topics and problems which were to be largely responsible for his return to Cambridge in 1929. That Wittgenstein did philosophy again, that is something which must be celebrated. Without his renewed interest in philosophy, we can safely say that the whole philosophy of the 20th century and the whole history of philosophy afterwards would have been different. That's why we are here, to celebrate that Wittgenstein did philosophy till the end of his life, and to celebrate it as we can best do, doing philosophy ourselves. Thank you for coming. Let's go immediately to work. Ramon Fabrega, the secretary of the chair, whom you met outside, will be only too happy to solve all your honest problems and to answer all your administrative questions. Our first day is devoted to philosophy of mathematics. But we will start with a lecture of a more general character. Our speaker will be Professor Brian McGuinness, professor at Siena University. He has been there for the last 13 years. When he left Girona in 1989, he went immediately to Siena. I thank Professor McGuinness for his kind willingness to accept our invitation. The title of his talk is, we'll talk on, do we need a new Wittgenstein? Thank you very much.
Perhaps I'll try standing up. Can I be heard?
No, reasonably.
Can I be heard?
No,
reasonably, no distortion. Well, of course, I've reached an age where I might be supposed to be hostile to the idea of a new Wittgenstein. And in fact, the whole subject reminds me of a poem in Welsh. I was born in Wales, which is in a way the Catalonia of Britain. And there is a poem, and there is there, if anybody speaks Welsh, they'll understand it, which begins, Aros Hangnas Eimawr. And it says the mountains, which are great big mountains, they remain. And every morning you hear, this is a romantic poem, every morning you hear the shepherds singing a song, as they always have done. But there are new shepherds on those mountains. On Big Island, never you see that again. And of course we see that is so. The last time we were here, I think three or four of us were here, we had the actual pupils of Wittgenstein with us. Now some of us can count, I think, as the first generation of interpreters, three or four of us. But obviously there will be a new generation. And in that sense, I have, of course, not only no objection, but it's very natural there should be a new Wittgenstein. I'm not going to talk particularly about the recent publication of New Wittgenstein. I wanted to know why people are looking for something new in Wittgenstein. And I think that there is a general prejudice, not on the part only of the authors represented in that book, a general prejudice against other people's views of what Wittgenstein was about. Other people's approach seems to be wrong, rather than what in detail they say. I found a slight confirmation of this in a brief interchange I had not long ago. I made fun of the movement in a feeble joke, which if you've heard it before from me, please excuse me. I said that the project of a new Wittgenstein reminded me of the advertising agency in a New Yorker cartoon. And in this agency, the people are about to buy the proposed slogan. And the slogan is, new, improved, Mom's old-fashioned apple pie. Well, one of the editors of the volume wrote back into the Times Literary Supplement, saying kindly, in a way, he was kind, that I was one of the people chiefly responsible for the view of Wittgenstein that his contributors wanted to contest, and that I would do well to address their theses in what I wrote. I therefore procured a copy of the book, only to find that there was in it no reference, although no reference to writings of my own in which I've tried to deal with the matters discussed, but not even to those of my colleague and, as they think, confederate David Baird, save briefly in the final chapter, which was a kind of answer to the whole project by Peter Hacker. In a certain measure, Peter Hacker belongs to the same school as we belong to, which I believe is now called Oxfordoxy. Oxfordoxy. And in the book, as we were saying, in the book, there is the same silence about, much more important matters, the correspondence with Paul Engelmann and the series of thinkers whose influence on Wittgenstein I and others have tried to illustrate. Weininger, Boltzmann, Hertz, and Spengler. So, I mean, it's as if the new Wittgensteinians are reviving the original sort of false philology, which tried to, it was said, explain Homer by Homer. Explain Dante by Dante was the next example, I think, of it. Now, as it happens, I was not wholly in disagreement with the new Wittgensteinians on a point particularly at issue. And in the review that gave offence, I point out precisely that Wittgenstein originally wrote an Abhandlung, which ended with the remark that the propositions of logic say nothing, and that there are no propositions of ethics. The mystical passages were added later, and I tried to explain why they were added later. And so, if I may quote, there's a writer on our subject who, it was akin, since we talk of Homer, to Thersites, Lawrence Goldstein, and he thinks that I am a resident reader of Wittgenstein's text. I suppose I could say that. What I do try to do, I think, if I may speak personally for a moment, is to read the writings in their context, and above all, in their genre, what type of composition we have before us, trying to see Wittgenstein in his habit as he lived. And the difficulty is, and it explains much, that he was a complicated character, and his writings are no less so. They don't lend themselves to straightforward reading, and there are structural reasons, as I shall hope to illustrate, for which the texts are almost bound to contain, at first sight, many theses and the contradictory of those theses. whether or not every reading of Wittgenstein must be a new one. The interpretation of the mystical and other passages in the Tractatus is a matter on which I've given my views to the world several times, beginning with an article on mysticism in 1965, not to mention earlier the well-remembered work on the translation with David Baird. For this reason, and also because I'm well persuaded of an essential unity in the work of Wittgenstein, unity in what I've sometimes called his intellectual project, I should like to illustrate my point, beginning from his later teaching and writing and commerce with his friends. Since his ways were often odd, it's important not to get into a position, I'm not trying to defend Wittgenstein, I'd rather not be his advocate, because that would hinder my efforts to understand him, and in particular to understand the striking effect he had on others, whether they knew him or not. An important feature, noted by many, George Kreiser, Rob Kreiser and J.P. Stern, was his determination to see everything as if for the first time. Of course, that's not a simple matter. It must be with a schooled eye, an educated eye, that one sees something for the first time, if it's to be of any use. It's as with the legendary mathematical professor who interrupts his lecture and walks around the cloister, as we say, before coming back and saying, yes, it is obvious. Or like Descartes, who advises running through proofs again and again until one can see the result following. These, at any rate, are related phenomena. In Wittgenstein's case, what he does is analyzes over examples and what we feel inclined to say, and crude errors even, which yet have some attraction for us. And then the word of release comes, what he calls the Erlösungswort, the word that sort of releases us from our puzzle. It's also a sort of redemptive word in some way. Sometimes this process seems like the threshing round of a cat in a cage, trying to get out, or not trying, well, I suppose it's trying to get out, but seems to be no method in it. The style then of his writings, or compilations, is dictated by this, by the desire to bring the reader into discussion and make him go through all the hoops, a sort of, if we comparing it with great writers, of course, here, a sort of platonic dialogue. And that's why he says it's essentially a colloquial style. Very far from, say, Max Beerbohm or something. The same effect is thought. The reader is sought. The reader is carried along with the writer, who seems to be just talking away. Views are put to him in a friendly manner. And then, at the end, the reader finds he's agreeing with perhaps more than he meant to. Now, this isn't Russell's style at all, which aims to be more Voltairean than Voltaire, assuming a different kind of agreement from the start, a complicity, rather, in the idea that all that's needed is brisk intelligence and fairly elementary aims in life. It's this aspect, I think, that led Wittgenstein to describe Russell's book, What I Believe, as durchaus nicht harmlos, not harmless at all. Another attributed remark is, what wouldn't one give for a little depth? I'm going to mention Gödel in a moment, and I should say here another parallel. With Wittgenstein and Gödel is that Gödel had a strange theory that the emperor of Austria, the Roman emperor as he what then was, suppressed an academy which Leibniz was forming because he thought it would make people too intelligent and he didn't want intelligent people. And so Maynard is fair asked him, but wouldn't he have suppressed the writings of Voltaire? And Gödel said, does anybody think that reading Voltaire would make you more intelligent? Reverting to Russell, some obviously Principles of Mathematics, 1900 book, is a really serious work, with very little of Russell's impishness in it. Very little, what do you say, impish? And that line in Russell's writing, Wittgenstein approved of, the before the First War, Russell sometimes wrote in a vaguely mystical style, and it looks as if Wittgenstein didn't approve this particularly. He says, some of your philosophical essays are on the level of Moore's Principia Ethica, and in his speech that was by no means praise. After the war, this is, Russell became much more down to earth and wrote about social matters and so on. It was Wittgenstein who became a mystic. The war for him had had the opposite effect to the one of Russell. And just as Russell in 1914 written an article, 1915 published a book with the title Mysticism and Logic, so now you might have called Wittgenstein's book Logic and Mysticism. Started with logic and went on to mysticism, reversing Russell's order. Incidentally, I have argued rather that that article by Russell had an effect on Wittgenstein, if only perhaps leading him to William James. But there are remarkable parallels. The style of the Tractatus is a separate problem. It has aphoristic conclusions in common with his conclusions in common with his later writings, but the steps for getting there have been, to some extent, omitted. We find some of them in his notebooks. As it stands, printed, it's a kind of parody of Principia Mathematica, and it's trying to show that and how logic ought to do without words. This is not a matter here of liking Russell's style or Wittgenstein's better. What the one wants to say couldn't be said in the manner of the other. To use one of Wittgenstein's similes, once again, observing all proportion, to imagine otherwise, to imagine what Wittgenstein has to say, said in the manner of Russell, would be like imagining what Goethe would have looked like when composing the Ninth Symphony. This is an example Wittgenstein uses. You can imagine what Beethoven reason for the nature of Wittgenstein's style resides in a very deep feature of his character. So this, to a certain extent, verifies his insistence that le style c'est l'homme, the essence of the man is to be found in his style. He had a general difficulty, not just with the idea, but also with the practice of communication. And here I give another parallel with Gödel, because Menger and Gödel came away from a meeting of the Vienna Circle, and these two mathematicians had been talking about language, and they hadn't said a word. And Menger says, well, there you are, we have out-Wittgensteined these Wittgensteinians. And so Gödel replied, the more I think about language, the more it amazes me that people ever understand each other. A good introduction to this feature of Wittgenstein is his correspondence, in particular that with Engelmann, which I've mentioned. He says again and again that on serious matters, he can only talk face to face. If a letter doesn't work to secure complete communication, how much less, and in a letter there's a possibility of exchange, but how much less a treatise would work to do this? I connect this approach with his lecture on ethics, Wittgenstein's lecture on ethics. He said, talking about ethics to Schlick and Weissmann, that there could not be a treatise on ethics. It would be a book, this is in the lecture itself, that would, as it were, blow up all other books. I think it's all more surprising that deontic logic, a subject than which none could be more un-Wittgensteinian, was the creation of his faithful pupil and chosen successor. He can only talk about these matters, ethics, in the first person. He talks about his experience. And he says, my experience par excellence. In the first edition, this was transcribed as, my experience for excellence, which is a crude misunderstanding. And what he means is that this is an experience of a quite different kind from all others. It isn't just my experience for excellence, like my experience of colour or my experience of something else. No, it's a different kind of experience. Well, indeed, Wittgenstein therefore talked in the first person about ethics, but in a way all of his talk was in the first person. Not that it was egoistic, but that it took, many people relate this, that it took, as well, it took the other person by the throat, or took him by the coat collar, or by the lapel, and insisted on a real relation, not an artificially limited one. It never accepted the artificial limitations. So this is something Iris Murdoch said, to some extent it was true of her too, and made her formidable. One student who went to Wittgenstein to see whether it was a good idea to go to his lectures or not, and the meeting went on and on, and it ended with Wittgenstein weeping over his own sins, sort of core loquitur, he said. So it's not the usual pattern for an office hour, but that's it. Now, in intellectual as well as personal matters, it's difficult in Wittgenstein's case to distinguish the two. Part of what needs to be conveyed is the process of thinking that has gone into what has been said, not just the completed result. Now, this may be a general truth, but it's particularly true in this case. But there is more to it than this. The way a thing is said, what costs to say it is part of what's been said. Thus, a written confession would be worth less than an auricular one. And Wittgenstein did make confessions to people, and he took care to recite them in person. 1937, that was. In a way, there's a failure of naturalness in, because he read them out from a text. I think one of Wittgenstein's great difficulties, I think I've said this elsewhere, was he wanted to be perfectly natural. And he was so keen on doing this, exaggerated, that he was artificial, in fact, in some ways. So it was a sort of an artificial naturalness, was like a sort of garden where you carefully plant wild flowers. Everybody says, oh, it's just a garden. These things can be seen affecting the production of his works. We think it was the thing we call his works, or what we call his works, the Notes on Logic. Their genesis is that he felt and said, I've got to Russell, I've got to come and dictate notes in your presence. Now, a slightly later version of his thoughts, which we also have printed, was dictated to Moore. They did these things together. At a later period, just slightly later, in the war, at Olmütz, Wittgenstein couldn't utter what he wanted to say. He seemed even to have difficulty in articulation until Engelmann extracted it from him, as with a forceps, like the midwife function of Socrates. In the early 30s, Wittgenstein tried to collaborate on a book with Weissner, on a book presenting his ideas. This led to great difficulty because he always changed his mind and wanted to. He didn't like it when he'd been written down and so on. Gordon Baker, had just finished a collection of the material, and it will be published shortly. I think it's called, I know it's going to be called Voices of Wittgenstein. Some of it is available in French, in a thing called Dictée, published by the Press University of the France. And it's interesting that this material is not identical with the typescripts or manuscripts from which Wittgenstein took his typescripts and manuscripts and discussed them with Weissner. But what came out from this was something different. It's not identical. At least I've tried to check, and I haven't found identity at all. So the collaboration, even dictation, made him put his ideas in a form which other persons present could accept. And later in Cambridge, he depended on Miss Ambrose and Skinner, your friend Skinner, he would have these two people, he would dictate to them. It was a delicate balance, and with Skinner alone, Skinner was too much a friend. He broke from his hands because they were both very sad about this, tears on both sides. But she couldn't come to be dictated to anymore, and he couldn't continue. So all the scrapping of work, tergiversations, are part of the same in the 1930s, are part of the same phenomenon. And so he determined that he would put everything that could be saved into a new volume, he wrote it down. Recently we found this work, this manuscript. And he brought this manuscript to Vienna, and he dictated from it. But then again, he had to dictate in the presence of his sister. He had, of course, the typist. He dictated from the typist. he had to have his sister, Gretchen, his sister Margaret Stonebrough, with him. They had long sessions. I mean, she talks about how the hot soup would be brought in to keep them going. So you can see it was a lot. In fact, you can see how many of these are. From his diary. So, in a way, what he needed, but could never accept, was a good editor. He needed somebody to work with. Instead, what he got was the literary heirs, who could precisely not perform the task of interacting with him. The more their goodwill, the greater their loyalty, the less they could modify his material and make it natural, turning what risked being a monologue into a dialogue. Well, now, is this just a literary problem to which a genius, Plato, say, would have found a solution? Actually, one thinks here, for example, Plato's dialogue of Phaedrus, which is the most eloquent demonstration that real philosophy cannot be found in a book. Of course, it's a book itself, but still, it's brilliantly done. Well, perhaps in Wittgenstein's case, too, the difficulty sometimes, the books may vary in quality. The difficulties cancel out, and the nature of the content shines through. And it is meant to be, very often, meant to be a dialogue. Positions are tried out, even absurd positions. We remember his remarks, you remember probably too, his remarks to Oscar Wood at his one Oxford talk, when he said, say something crude, say what you really think, because Oscar began with David at this occasion, when we can start talking. He said, Oscar Wood began to say something and then said, withdrew it, started to qualify it, you see, and say it properly. He said, no, don't try and correct yourself. Say something crude, say what you really think, and we shall get somewhere. Yeah. So this sort of style, with which he corresponds to the aim, which is the active and cooperative comprehension on the part of the reader and the writer of the philosophical predicament. There's something to be said on each side, but it's easy to tip over into absurdity. Then it is that the reminder of the obvious has a revelatory effect, reveals something. Many examples familiar to us all. The man who shows how tall he is by putting his hand on his head. The purchase of two copies of the daily paper for reassurance as to its content. Frenchman who finds that only in French do words come in the order one thinks them. The hygienic or therapeutic effects of this require that the confusions be recreated. I just want to put something else there. Thus the codification of the method in a doctrine or theory is impossible. The moment you take the obvious slogan without the context, that makes it have a point. You're using one of Wittgenstein's similes, another simile. You're turning a wheel not attached to any engine. So I want to quote a parallel to that remark to Oscar Wood. It's a sort of translation of a remark by St. Augustine. Et vita gentibus deite, coniam, loquatis mutis sunt. Nobody knows exactly what it means, but Wittgenstein translates it like this. Well, I translate it in German, then I translate it in English. What, you swine? Sorry, he talks like this. You swine. You want not to talk nonsense. this was in the context of ethics, context of ethics and religion. Well, I return to the general remarks about Wittgenstein's style, and the hygienic or therapeutic effect is obvious, and to some it seemed the whole purpose. Weismann wrote a piece called How I See Philosophy, and this was in fact drawn from conversations with Wittgenstein, another consultation with the Georg Gordon Baker. Weismann had really come to think of it as his own, confusing the shortened formulation with the original idea, which was deliberately vaguer. The therapy is not just a catharsis. There is an element of seeing the world aright, as he says in the case, at the end. There's something positive in the impossibility at the root of what there's something to be learned from the impossibility, Mary Stroud will tell us more, of this, of providing an account of the origin or nature of thought or language, something positive in the hostility to theory. The aim, the purpose or drive is sometimes described as that of coming to a clear general view, Übersicht, of an area. But this is precisely not a theory. I've compared it elsewhere to the method of Goethe. Nature is neither husk nor kernel, you know, in that, but all things at one stroke. So the parallels between Goethe's idea of methodology in natural history and Wittgenstein's philosophical method in his later writings have been drawn convincingly by Joachim Schulte. I can give you a reference for that. A careful consideration of cases in detail, which naturally constitutes, demonstrates analogies, leads to a certain form of understanding of a domain, which may be exactly the understanding we require. It was in this way that Spengler, whom Wittgenstein names as an influence, exhibited the likenesses and differences of human societies. Wittgenstein describes, and in part illustrates, how a similar method could be applied to the rites and practices that form the subject of Fraser's The Golden Bough, this in the things that have been printed as, Remarks on Fraser's The Golden Bough, I think it's called, yes. There he draws on and uses for his own purposes Spengler's notion of family resemblances. These will enable us to get a perspicuous representation Darstellung of a field of study. Now, this matter has, of course, both moral and intellectual aspects. We essential bivalence of the proposition is a circular one, depending on the determinacy of sense. I've tried to argue this in a paper on the unsaleable. Another aspect of the same circularity is the paradox of Frege's Fregean paradox, paradox derived from Frege, that the sense of the proposition depends upon the meanings of its components, yet at the same time, the components only have meaning in the context of a proposition. This is part of the general difficulty of producing a theory of language as such, which, as I have indicated, appears in its later philosophy. And then, for the earlier period, as you know, the unsayability of propositions. The unsayability of propositions about ethics and the sense of the world. So we have to see, if we're to understand Wittgenstein, we have to see that these absurdities are the necessary result of seeking to go outside language as we feel driven to do. Now, Wittgenstein condones this, he said, in Heidegger. He said, I see what Heidegger would be at, it's more like Mill's remark about Mill, on the Corley's remark about Kant. Yes. I see what Kant would be at. And again, in the lecture on ethics, he sees the tendency to run up against the limits of language as one that by no means condemns an important part of philosophy itself is such an attempt, and we must recognize both its attractions and of the impossibility that it should actually bring us to port. There's much of there's a poem by Browning called Rabbi Ben Ezra, which is reminiscent in many ways of Wittgenstein, and it talks about fancies that broke through language and escaped. But, to go back to Lawrence Goldstein, he thinks that my long-held conviction that the ladder propositions, the propositions of the Tractatus, Wittgenstein says, these form a ladder, which you must throw away when you go to the top, I suppose that means that they are themselves nonsensical and can be thrown away. Dr. Goldstein said, this is possible but highly improbable. This only shows that Dr. Goldstein, who is for all his enfant terrible, is a simple enough fellow at heart. If the theist were not improbable, it couldn't possibly be true, and certainly wouldn't appeal to Wittgenstein. See, this is the idea that the bourgeois thinker, sorry to call Dr. Goldstein a bourgeois thinker, but bourgeois thinkers do not realize what desperate measures are required. Bourgeois thinker, this was Wittgenstein's reproach to Gramsci. I know it came after, and I think it came because Ramsay no longer accepted Wittgenstein's critique of foundations of mathematics as such. And a thing on which this turned very much was problems on the nature of identity, in the notion of identity. And Ramsay had previously thought that these were fatal to Russell's position, but now thought he found a way around them. You can see some evidence, of this in the fact that Ramsay wrote an article for the Encyclopedia Britannica in 1926 which completely takes Wittgenstein's position. And then in 1927 he wrote an article on the foundations of mathematics where he adopted the sort of device I've indicated to get around Wittgenstein's objections. And Wittgenstein criticized and answered this letter. Rather strange letter, but well, we don't need to put it all down. Well, what then are we to take away from Wittgenstein? I'm right here of what Ryle, Gilbert Ryle, teacher of many of us, or some of us, said about Wittgenstein when he was asked how Wittgenstein influenced him. And he said, I've learned a lot from him. Okay. Well, this is learning something. This perhaps end, the works of Wittgenstein, perhaps end, as indeed Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics does, with the phrase, now let's start on the real thing, let's start on, well, thing is to carry on from there. There will be problems enough. The first generation of pupils, I don't know, the first generation of pupils, which consisted of pupils, thought that the problems existed in rear and maturity, that they were just there. Only a Wittgenstein would have seen them as if for the first time. But in fact, the problems came from Wittgenstein's background, or backgrounds, Vienna with Wolfstein, there in Cambridge and Manchester with Frege and Russell, again in Vienna with Weininger, Ramsen, with Schlick, with Moore, the sort of thing people were interested in all of these places. And, of course, it's natural to suppose that there will be new problems, and therefore I think we should, in some sense, always be having a new literature. Dixie.
Well, it's up to you now to make comments or suggestions or position.
Does it work? Maybe just as a way of opening the discussion more than asserting or stating it. Yeah. No? Oh, it was just trying to open a discussion if anyone is. I tried to speak English. I was just saying that I'm trying to speak English.
Yes, yes. All right.
Sorry. No, come on.
This is going to be more difficult than
it. Oh, come on, I told you.
No, it was
the first person speaking, you see.
When you were saying that, stating the limits of language and knowledge about when you were saying that there is something positive in the impossibility of providing an account of language, and you were saying that was not just a question of therapy, of catharsis,
yeah,
but something else.
Well, yes.
Could you please go on this point? But because I always thought that the point here was more a kind of therapy, knowing the limits in a sense of psychologically, that pacifies our search for knowledge, our search for absolute, or our search for something else that it cannot be given to us, or we cannot understand, or there is nothing else to look for. In the sense of a catharsis of therapy, I understand it. But you were saying there was more to it. Could you please?
Well, yes, should I take that? I think I tried to say it. I think I was trying to say that you can see in the works themselves that I tried to give this idea of giving the übersichtliche Darstellung, the overview, and I said it's a different method in philosophy, different method. It's not a systematic theory. It's a matter of giving a description of things, not description of many things in this Goethe-like way. Trying to bring out what there is there by showing the analogies between different things. It's like the difference. I mean, because after all, the point about family resemblance is you see that the family resemblance idea, which can sometimes be very deleterious, can be very bad, I suppose, for people. The idea is that's very different from giving a definition You can't give an exact definition, but you can show the sort of things that are there, and you can only do it by giving, showing analogies. And that was what Goethe thought he would do too, well, Goethe and Spengler. So I thought that the idea of the übersichtliche Darstellung was, all right, what the therapy led you to. It was something positive. It's not as if you say, okay, we don't need to do philosophy, that's one subject less, as it were, you know, cancel that department. And nobody wants that to happen, at least we don't. I don't know. Is that enough? Perhaps not. Barry.
I wondered if you could say a bit more about the idea of a bourgeois thinker. What do you think Wittgenstein had in mind by that? And in particular, whether you think that a bourgeois thinker, as he thought of it, was one or is one who thought or thinks that an account or a theoretical account or explanation of language and thought can be given. Wittgenstein. I would like you to say what you think Wittgenstein meant by the idea of a bourgeois thinker.
Yes.
And in particular, whether a bourgeois thinker, as he understands it, is a person who thinks that there is or can be a theoretical explanation of language and thought. And if so, what's bourgeois about that?
Save mathematics. There is mathematics, it's going on, it's a good subject, and we want it to be all right. So any devices that we can use to save it are okay, because all we want to do is to go on doing mathematics. And that was actually what Ramsay does, you see. He said, well, I'm not trying to... Wittgenstein said, well, it's impossible to define identity. And Ramsay don't need to define identity, they just have a thing which works like identity and will give us the whole of mathematics. So that was in that context, the bourgeois thinker was one who wanted to keep things the way they were, you see. I'm not sure, therefore, that it does apply exactly to the... I don't see it as connected particularly with giving an account, except that I'd like to think about that. I don't... That particular criticism of his, we're not tied to it. Me. I mean, he could be against theory, the idea of giving a theory in language, not thinking it was particularly bourgeois.
But, excuse me, I believe when in the investigation Wittgenstein mentions that Ramsay was a bourgeois thinker, he brings in the idea of normative. He doesn't realize that logic is a normative science, or something like that, he says.
He doesn't realize that.
From Ramsay, where he wrote that intuitionists were introducing Bolshevism in mathematics. So I think that it was anti-intuitionists and then bourgeois.
That's right. That's the thing I was thinking of. But this other point is an interesting one. That logic is a normative science. No, I can't see it. I don't know.
Microphone. This is easier about your question, but
it works.
No.
Okay.
gives a theory that has the effect of saving the practices, but by putting them on a new theoretical basis. So a Buddha thinker isn't going to be just somebody who leaves everything as it is, that is, stays with our present understanding, but it's going to be somebody who gives a theory for why we don't need to change. So it seems like he thinks of Ramsey's pragmatism as a paradigm of Bolshevism. So he has a certain picture of pragmatism where we keep using the word truth the way we use it, we keep using the identity symbol the way we use it, but we provide this theory that gives us a good conscience about our using these terms the way we do. So that gives me some sense of how it might connect up with bourgeois as a term of a political concept for a certain kind of theory. That was always my understanding. But so then it wouldn't be someone who generally wants to give a theoretical account of language, would be a bourgeois thinker, but somebody who gives a certain kind of account. I don't know if that helps.
First of all, I thought, just in passing about this last remark, I thought it was the artificiality of Ramsey's solution, the identity and extension, that was the target there. Could I ask you about something else, though? Something new? Is this on? Yeah. The business about the mystical, you remarked it was added later, and I'm sure that's right. It is strange in the following way. He wants to say that there are certain things that cannot be said, right? The propositions of the Tractatus, the latter propositions, they can't be said, they're recognized as meaningless. He says the same thing about ethical propositions. There's an ethical life, not with no ethical propositions. The thing that's curious about it, he does utter these ethical propositions. Why does he draw a distinction between saying something affirmatively rather than negatively? A tautology and a contradiction ought to show the very same thing. There should be no difference. Everything you could illustrate by the propositions being tautologies is illustrated by being contradictions. Why isn't that the same? Why does he give a particular content to his mystical propositions? Couldn't he just as well have said the life of the happy man is just the same, the world of the happy man is just the same as the world of the unhappy man? And wouldn't that show the very same thing, perhaps in his fall?
Do too, you see. you know, there's nothing definite. That's not a factual. I'm not sure that you use the tone of the thing. If you, I don't say if you don't like, you recognize. And I think that tone is there. I think it's got very much to do with the situation. You know, with, also he's a pessimistic sort of person, but it was a complete collapse of the world.
There are no more questions, then we can...
Okay, then.
If there are no more questions, we can have a pause now. And we'll go outside. Well, if you wish to stay here, you can, of course. But we will have coffee outside. Coffee. I'm not sure coffee has arrived by now, but if it hasn't, it will. Let's hope so. And we start in, let's take 25 minutes. Fine.